Okay, so let us start. Okay, so yesterday, please. So yesterday, I ended up with showing you that when trying to quantize by functional integration a non-abelian gauge theory, like the non-abelian gauge theory based on the group SU2. We could play the same, exactly the same rules than when quantizing the Maxwell field. So fixing a gauge, taking into account the fact that we have to measure the volume of the orbit, so there is a change in the functional integration measure. And but so fixing the gauge means changing the propagator for the gauge field. But in that case, we have a propagator such that the unphysical modes of the gauge field, like the modes with the longitudinal polarizations, propagates. Okay? And in addition, for non-abelian gauge theories, we saw that we end up with a determinant of some operator, which was the determinant of this famous Fadiyev-Popov operator. So we ended up with having to add in the functional integral the absolute value of a determinant of an operator. And this operator was simply the ordinary derivative times, let us write it, times the covariant derivative. So the ordinary derivative is just the ordinary derivative in four-dimensional space-time. But I remind you that I am in the case of an SU2 gauge theory. I am integrating over the vector field. So I am integrating over the vector field A mu A of x, where A goes from 1 to 3. So A labels the number of independent generators of the SU2 gauge group or of its Lie algebra, and the SU2 gauge group has a three, has dimension three, so there are three generators. Okay? Yes?
Is that like a covariant object?
The
two derivatives, is that something that is covariant?
This is not covariant. Because if this was covariant, this would be gauge invariant. And the Fadiyev-Popov determinant takes into account the fact that we have fixed the gauge, we have to make the computation, but we have broken gauge invariant. So this is, of course, this d mu is gauge invariant, but this ordinary mu is not gauge invariant. So this d mu, remember, what was it? The d mu acts is an operator which acts on the elements of the Lie algebra. So the d mu is an operator which is defined as d mu equals d mu plus the structure constant. So d mu acts on some on the space of objects. So d mu like on an object which depends on some, for example, let us take alpha A, the generator, gauge transformation. Okay, and d mu acts on alpha A as dA d mu of alpha A plus FABC A mu B alpha C. That's the definition, if I am correct, of the gauge derivative. That's the covariant derivative. And this, of course, this covariant derivative, of course, is a non-trivial object because it depends on the gauge field configuration. And we have to compute an operator, a differential operator, which is the d mu times the covariant derivative of d mu. So we have to compute the determinant of an operator, which is d. So let us write it explicitly. This operator is d mu times d mu. So this is the scalar Laplacian, d mu, d mu. So this operator, d mu, d mu, is the ordinary Laplacian plus. And then you have two terms, because when d mu acts on this, you have d mu, d mu plus f a, b, c, a mu, b of x, x d mu acting on c. You see, so you can write this as an operator a, c. So this is an operator acting on vector with three components, and we get an f a b c a mu b d mu acting on alpha c plus d mu, mu is here, d mu a b of x times, and that's it. So you see, so this operator contains the ordinary Laplacian, plus a term involving one derivative times the gauge field, plus a term involving the derivative of the gauge field itself. So it's a non-trivial object.
Question?
Yes?
Where's the other index mu on the... because there's the mu on the far right is not contracted with
anything. Oh, the index is of course here. Okay. A depends on mu. D mu, so this is the divergence of the gauge vector. This is the divergence. You are right. Thank you. This is the divergence of the vector potential, and this is the vector potential times the gradient operator. Okay. So, and that's a general formula. It's true for the SU to gauge theory, where FABC is just fully antisymmetric tensor, but that's a general formula. Okay. So, now, what is how can we compute such a complicated object in when doing calculation? That's where this the trick of Fadeyev and Popov enters, it was also an idea of Feynman and DeWitt, which is to use anti-commuting, so Grassmann, represented by Grassmann variables. So use anti-commuting scalar fields to represent this operator, this determinant. So the idea is the following. If I set aside the fact that I have to compute, in fact, the absolute value of the determinant, which forget about it at the moment, I can write the determinant of this operator, d mu, as a functional integral over two fields. I will introduce two fields. So I will first write this, and I will explain what it means. I will write this as exponential of I integral d4x of, and then I will write this operator exponential, d4x, and then I will write c bar minus this operator, d mu times c. Okay? So what does this mean? I am introducing two anti-commuting Grassmann scalar fields which are conjugate to each other. So C, in fact, is a scalar field which, it has to carry an index relative to the generator of the group, because that's an operator which is a matrix. So C is, in fact, a field Cx with an index A here. So there are three. This is a field which has three components. So it belongs to the Lie algebra of the group. But its components are its component are anti-commuting numbers. So C is a set of C, three components. Okay. And so we can write it, if you prefer, with my notation as CA of X times TA, where the TA were the generators of the Lie algebra. So for instance, you can write C as CA of X times some Pauli matrices. So remember that SU2, the generator TA, are one half of the sigma A, where sigma A are the 2 by 2 Pauli matrices. Okay. And then we have, so C bar is its conjugate. So C bar is in fact C A bar of X times T A. I write it that way. So this is called the ghost field. And this is called the anti-ghost field. Okay? And I am applying the rules. I will apply the standard rules of quantization with Grassmann fields. Okay. So what does this term represent? This term simply represents C bar A of X, this operator, so minus d mu of times applied on CA of X, summed over A, and then minus C bar A of X, F A B C, this operator, d mu over a mu b of x c with an index little c of x. You see? So this is this, what this term represents is just in terms of component summing over all the indices. Two terms. You see, you have a term which represents just a propagator for free field, and an interaction terms. Yes.
You said that the ghost and anti-ghost fields are scalar fields.
Yeah.
But T was defined as a 2 by 2 matrix. So
okay. So the C's are the C's and C bars, and C bars carry charges for the gauge group of SU2. And I will discuss a little bit later exactly what are the charges. So they are charge field. But they do not carry any Lorentz or Dirac indices.
Okay,
you see?
But they do carry so Pauli indices?
They do carry which kind of indices?
Or because the 2 by 2 Pauli matrices?
Yes, they carry the A indices. So that's just a representation. Do not think of the Pauli matrices as matrices representing the spin. Just think of them as elements of the Lie algebra of the SU2 group. Remember, the SU2 group is a group of unitary matrices, 2 by 2 complex unitary matrices. Its Lie group is a set of traceless Hermitian 2 by 2 complex matrices, okay? And a basis of the set of traceless Hermitian symmetric matrices is provided by the three Pauli matrices. But that's just a representation of this mathematical object, and this has nothing to do with the rotation group in real space.
Okay, so
okay.
We treat each
the, if you view the Pauli, yeah. Pardon? Excuse me.
What was the thing you said?
The matrices.
You can have three color indices on a scalar field. So A,
yeah. You see, the you can view the Pauli matrices as matrices representing rotations, but these rotations correspond to SU2 transformation in the space of internal space of symmetries of the field.
Okay.
So if there are rotations, those are rotations in the SU2 group. Okay? So there's nothing to do with spin and Lorentz transformation. Completely disconnected. Well, on one hand, you have the Lorentz group. On the other hand, you have the SU2 group with an internal group of symmetry of the fields of your theory. Okay? Okay, so they carry charges of SU2, but no spin. They are spin zero operator. The spin will be the ordinary spin. This will tell you how the fields transform under Lorentz transformations. Okay? So they are scalars. That's what I meant by scalar. Okay? The AMU are vector fields. The fermions are spinor fields. The ghosts are scalar. Okay? So now, what does this... So this tells us that if I want to take into account this Fadeyev-Popov determinant, which I have to in order to build a theory which is gauge invariant, I have to, one way to do that is to introduce additional particle, or would-be particle, in the Hilbert space of the theory, which are the ghosts and the anti-ghosts. And the ghosts and the anti-ghosts, you see, how do they behave? First, you have a linear term, you have a term in the action which is just quadratic, C bar C. So it tells you that this, the ghost, if you, I keep this term, propagate as ordinary particles. So what is the propagator for the ghost? What is the propagator for the ghost? For the ghost? The propagator for the ghost is simply, if I want to compute, so I am computing in the time order product of a ghost at point X, or let us say at point X, and an anti-ghost with a quantum number B at point Y. Okay, and it's not very complicated to see that since this term is nothing but the Laplacian, the propagator of the ghost will be exactly the same than the propagator of a scalar particle, because the ghosts are spin zero particles. So this is nothing but integral d4p over 2 pi to the 4 exponential I p times x minus y. The propagator of the scalar particle, which is 1 over p squared. And then I have to take into account the fact that you have the index A and B. And but here I have a sum over repeated indices, so this is just delta AB. Okay? So you see the indices, the charges carried by the ghosts are carried along. Okay? And this is just the propagator of a scalar particle. So the ghost is like a scalar particle. But for an important difference, the ghosts are Grassmann fields. Okay? So when I compute the expectation value of T C bar B of X of Y, let us say, C A of X, for a scalar particle, this should be the same than this. Yes, because of the time order of prescription, this should be the same. You see? Now, since the C's and the C bar are Grassmann fields, they anti-commute. So this is equal to minus the propagator C A of X, C bar B of Y. Okay? So you see that as far as their propagation behaves, the propagator of the ghost is the propagator of a scalar massless field. But as far as the commutation relation between the fields is concerned, they behave like fermions. They obey the Fermi statistics. So they have spin zero, but they obey the Fermi statistic. the anti-commutes. Okay? And that's, of course, for the point of view of physics, very bad, because you have a general theorem of in quantum field theory, but you know very, very many examples, and you can check it for free particles, which states that a particle with even spin must be a boson, and a particle with odd spin must be a fermion. And that's called the spin statistic theorem. Okay? And here we are constructing a set of fields, so an Hilbert space, which with particles which are fermions with an odd, with an even spin, zero. So this particle cannot be physical. Yes?
Can you remind us what are the conditions of the spin statistics theorem?
Pardon?
Can you remind us what are the conditions of the spin statistics theorem?
Okay, the condition of the spin statistics theorem are that the theory must be local. You must have field operators located in small region of space-time. So you must have locality plus causality. Well, causality, in some sense, is the same thing as locality. You must not have a correlation between operator, which means that you have information going at a speed faster than the speed of light. And there is a precise definition of those statements in the framework of quantum field theory, but I won't discuss that. It's, okay, and then you have, of course, Lorentz invariants.
So does that mean that ghosts violate one of those three?
Pardon?
Does that mean...
Oh, I'm sorry. And of course, unitarity. I'm sorry. I forgot. So you need to have to locality and causality. You will need to have Lorentz invariants, but that's one set. In fact, in some sense, that's one set of...
Are those first two the axioms of axiomatic field theory?
Yes, those are the axioms of axiomatic quantum field theory. But axiomatic quantum field theory is not really axiomatic. It's just a formulation of the axioms which are needed by any quantum theory of nature. And then people are doing math out of that. But so you need to have a theory which satisfies Lorentz invariants. Locality, which means that, in fact, object can be defined at short domain in space-time. So the physics is local. And you need to have unitarity. Unitarity means that you need to have positive probabilities, basically. Your theory describes events, and the theory assigns probability to observe some events, and those probability must be in between 0 and 1. Okay? Otherwise, your theory doesn't make sense at the level of logic. Okay. And with those three requirements, you have several theorems. One of the theorems is a spin statistic theorem, one of the consequences.
So yes? Where do ghosts fail away?
So, where this, of course, if you look at such a kind of interaction, it satisfies locality because you have local fields. It satisfies Lorentz invariance because this is a spin zero particle and the propagator is a Laplacian. So what it has to not satisfy is unitarity. Okay? Yes. It has to break unitarity.
Right.
Yes?
Is that the propagator for the free ghost field?
That's a propagator for the free ghost field, so it means when the coupling constant of the theory is zero. Because remember that each gauge field comes to the coupling constant G when I do the rescaling. I'm starting from the action where the action for the gauge field is 1 over G squared minus 1/4 trace of F mu nu. Okay, this is the action for the Young mean fields. Okay, so in fact, when you do the perturbative expansion, each time you have an A field, it comes with a G. So this is the term at three level, and this is the term over the G. Okay? Okay, so that's the propagator. So that's the propagator for the ghost in the limit when the gauge fields decouple. The gauge field decouples, but they are still there, so you still need to ghost to quantize the theory in a consistent way. Yes?
Okay, so I think there's something I'm not quite getting. So we introduced those C as a way to calculate or determine.
Yes.
Because it's a nice way to sum
yes.
over this some sort of behavior
yes.
thing. And so why do we go from there to assigning some sort of actual meaning to those variables, which are just a mathematical trick?
I will go to that later for the moment.
OK, and then if they're actually a ghost,
yes,
do they carry a degree of freedom? And where is it?
You will see later.
OK.
OK, for the moment, I'm just building some strange quantum theory just to represent this determinant. OK? So. So unitarity is broken. So this is a theory which is not unitary. Okay, not unitary means simply that when you compute matrix element of ghosts, so if you have a state with ghosts in the theory and another state and the state, this may very well be negative. Some states which carry ghost numbers are positive, but some have a negative norm. Okay? But for the moment, we are just building a functional integral representation of this determinant. So we don't care about the physics. I'm just explaining what are the properties of these strange fields. But for the moment, I'm doing something perfectly licit. What I'm doing is that I'm writing a determinant of some operator as a determinant of the functional integral of the exponential of some action for some field. Okay. Okay, so now let us go to the second. So once I have been doing that, let us look at the second term. The second term is this one. So this is propagator. Okay, so now let us see at the second term. The second term represents the fact that there is a coupling between the ghosts and the gauge field. So there is a coupling term, which is C bar A C, some sense, with some indices and some derivative. But simply, the ghost gets coupled to the gauge field. OK? So I will have in my theory. So let me represent the propagator with a ghost, a C bar expectation value. I represent it, so I will represent the ghost by dashed line. And since the ghosts are conjugate to each other, they carry a charge like the fermions, the Fermi field. So I have to represent the flow of charge from C to C bar by saying that the C is here and the C bar is here, for instance. Okay. So I represent the propagator with the ghost by a dashed line with an arrow to indicate that I'm going from here to there, and then creating a ghost and then annihilating the ghost, or creating an anti-ghost and annihilating a ghost. And then this means that I have a vertex like that. So this is a gauge field. This is a ghost, and this is an anti-ghost. And I have a vertex of interaction. I have a vertex of interaction between the ghost and the anti-ghost. Okay? And what is the form of this vertex if I apply my Feynman rules? The form of this vertex is simply, here it is, I think. No, it's not here. It is simply, well, you can compute it. In the action, I have an I factor. I have a minus CAB. I have an FABC. And I will have a G. So I will have, to each ghost, a factor of the form. Where is it? Minus G, if I am right. I So the ghost carry a number, so they a charge number. So here I have an mu c. The ghost carry an index a. The anti-ghost carries an index b. The gauge field carries an index c, and the Lorentz index mu. Okay, and if I am writing the things properly, I think here, this vertex, in this vertex, this line carry a momentum p. These lines carry a momentum q. These lines carry a momentum k, where k plus q equal p, if you want. So p is a momentum. P is a momentum carried by the anti-ghost in this representation. And then I have something which is p mu times p mu here times f abc. So you see that there is a factor associated to this vertex representing the interaction between the ghosts and the gauge field, which is proportional to the structure constant of the algebra times the momenta carried by the outcoming anti-ghost. Okay? That's the rules. And the rules comes just from this term. Okay? And this has the correct quantum number and satisfies the symmetry of the theory. It's a Lorentz invariant term, etc., because it represents this term. Okay? Yes?
So since C is killer, doesn't have, you know, polarization vector, so who does that P contract with?
It contracts with the mu index of the gauge field. You see, so when you will be constructing, calculating an amplitude, I will show that a bit later. If you have a diagram, consider present a diagram. Well, I will present. If you have a diagram where sometimes there is the propagator of for the gauge field, it carries mu indices, it carries vector indices because the vector, the gauge field has polarization, and this p is multiplied, is projected on the polarization of the. Of the gauge field. So this term represents the polarization of the, well, I'm sorry, the momentum of the anti-ghost, of the ghost field. We have a ghost partial propagating. And this is the momentum of the ghost, and the momentum of the ghost is projected on the polarization of the incoming gauge field. Okay? Good. And that's something which is the Lorentz invariant quantity. That's everything is consistent. Okay. So once we have done that, you see, we end up with an action which is a sum of the Young-Mills action. Well, let us write it plus integral d4x, if I have fermions, psi bar I d slash minus m psi. And to this action, I have to add a term which is represented by the gauge fixing condition, which is, remember, I add a d4x, 1 over 2 zeta d mu a mu squared. This was the term which was representing the fact that we have chosen generalized Lorentz gauge condition. This comes from the gauge fixing. Gauge fixing. But in addition to this, I must add this action, C bar minus d mu C. Okay. Okay, and it is this theory, S equals S Young-Mills plus S gauge fixing, which give you the correct way to compute correlation functions and S-matrix elements and the physical amplitudes in the theory of gauge field coupled to fermions. And in that case, you have to, if you had a gauge fixed term and you have to do that in order to compute physical quantities, you have to take into account the fact that you must introduce, represent the Fadeyev Popov determinant by this term representing gauge field, ghost field interacting with the vector fields. Okay? Okay? Good. Okay, so now I want to come back to. I want to resume the Feynman rules of the theory we have constructed. And then you will see what's going on. So let us forget about everything and about functional integrals. And let us now go back to what are the Feynman rules of such a theory. What are the such a theory. So a theory where we have a vector field, we have matter fields, and we have ghosts. Okay? And I will do that in a slightly different way because you have seen that everywhere in the so we have interaction between the matter fields and the gauge fields. We have nonlinear terms, so we have interaction between the gauge field, and we have interaction between the ghost and the fermions. And all of these interaction terms involve the structure constant of the theory, those F, A, B, C. And all the properties of the symmetry of the theory are contained in the F, A, B, C. And in fact, if you want to check that the theory is gauge invariant or that the theory satisfies the symmetry you started from, the SU2 theory, you have to work out relation between the structure constant. So you have to do algebras. And that's what one does. There is a rule theory. If you are familiar with group theory and Lie algebra theory, you don't find it difficult. But it's a bit difficult to see the symmetry of the theory just looking at the Feynman rules. So I will present it in a slightly different way, which is a very nice way. I think it has been developed by Gerard Toft in the 70s, in the famous paper in 74. He used that. I think it was known before. I will represent the interaction of the and the propagating degrees of freedom in a slightly different way by using looking at the gauge theory SU2, I will look at the theory of U2. Okay? So U2 is a set of unitary matrices, but without the constraints that the determinant is 1. Okay? So it's simply it has one additional degrees of freedom. But the advantage is that in that case, its Lie algebra is so the Lie algebra of U2. Is the Lie algebra of symmetric, so the little U2, the Lie algebra equals the algebra of Hermitian matrices. But you have removed the constraint that those matrices have to be traceless. Okay? Okay. So if you do that, it means that so Hermitian matrices are matrices which are carry 2 indices. Okay, and therefore, what does it mean? It means that the indices A of the generator of a group goes from 1 to 4. Okay, but what are those indices? Those indices are simply the sets of pairs of indices where the IG goes from 1 to 2 because we are going to the we are dealing with the group SU2. U2 is a set of 2 by 2 Hermitian matrices. Okay, so I will see. So what I am saying more easily is that I can represent an element of A mu A as so one component of the gauge field is simply one component of a 2x2 matrix IG. So I mean A mu is equal to an Hermitian is a 2x2 Hermitian matrix. Okay, and I so A mu is simply a matrix with a component A mu 1 1, A mu 1 2, A mu 2 1, A mu 2 2. Okay, this matrix is symmetric. It means that the A 1 1 is real, A 2 2 is real, A 1 2 is complex, and A 2 1 is its complex conjugate. But you can choose as a basis for your Lie algebra, the fact that this is the first element, this is the first generator, this is the first component, this is the second component, this is the third component, this is the fourth component. And instead of labeling the components by 1, 2, 3, 4, I label them by 1, 1, 1, 2, 2, 1, 2, 2. Okay? So instead of this, I go to this notation. Okay? And I will even be a little bit more careful. I will label the right component, so the component of the column of the column by an G with a underline, and the I by G. So I have I and G. So it's just to remind that this is the index of the line and this is the index of the column. But I and G bar goes to 1, 2, 2. Okay. Okay, so now you see that the gauge field, in fact, we start from a theory which has two charge. IG are the charge of the theory. You know, instead of having, like in electrodynamics, one fermion field which has charge minus one, because it's the electron and the positron has charge plus one, I have two charge. So in this theory, I have two charges. Okay, the first charge that I can let us call it this I. So I have, in the case I equal 1, I have a charge, and let us call this charge, let us give it the name of a color, because after all, we are trying to build a theory of quantum chromodynamics, and in quantum chromodynamics, the charges are called color. So let us call this charge, blue. Okay, so one will be blue. And two, if I equal two, the charge will be called the red charge. Okay? So you have two charges. Either the particle is blue or the particle is red. Okay? And of course, for the anti-particle, I bar means that underscored means that I am a particle which is an antiparticle which is an anti-blue particle, an antiparticle which is blue. So I can call this an anti-blue, and I can call this, it's just names, anti-red. Antiparticle, an anti-red particle. Okay? So instead of having electron and positron, I have blue electrons or blue quarks and anti-blue quarks and red quarks and anti-red quarks. Okay. Because so the psi I, for instance, with this notation, the psi I, the vector field, the matter field. You know, remember, the matter fields carry an I in the index, while the gauge field carry an A in the index. So the gauge field carry two charges. You have four states for the gauge field, and you have two possible states for the matter field. Okay. So the gauge bosons are either blue, or blue-red, or red-blue, or red-red. Okay.
So the diagonal elements A11, that would be a color neutral.
It will be color neutral. Yes. Yeah. Yes, it will be color neutral. But I am in a theory with an U2 symmetry, so I may very well have color neutral particles. And in fact, I have two color neutral particles, the red anti-red and the blue anti-blue. Okay? Yes?
In that case, you don't compact the AMUs with the generators of Lie algebra.
Yeah, but that's what I, what I'm meaning by that is that in fact I have two, and you can write it in that way. If you prefer to write it that way, I can write this as AMU is AMU IG bar times T IG bar. When you have four generators, the generator when you have a 1 0 0 0, the generator when you have 0 1 0 0, the generator when you have 0 0 1 0, and you have the generator when you have 0 0 0 1. Okay?
Is the fact that the generators that you just cited are not Hermitian? Well, does it
they are Hermitian.
Well, 0 1 0 0 is not Hermitian.
0 1. Ah, okay. So you can choose.
You can choose
an Hermitian base. It's just a representation. You can choose an Hermitian base.
Pauli matrix is plus.
So, okay. I write the generator like that, but they are Hermitian, which means that I impose that, for instance, that I know that A mu I G bar has to be the complex conjugate of A mu G I bar. Okay? The complex conjugation means that I have this constraint. Okay? Good. Okay. So once I have been doing that, it will be convenient to rewrite all the rules. Now, what is the propagator of the gauge field? The propagator of the gauge field is propagator. Okay? For the gauge field, the propagator is AIG bar. I put the index in there, but IG bar mu AKL bar mu. And I am computing a vacuum expectation value of this in the free theory. And what do I get? I get delta I L bar, delta G bar K, times P mu nu, where P mu nu is the propagator of the photon. That's the propagator of the photon, so P mu nu is just in Fourier component, it's remember what it was. It was minus I times P squared, and then there was delta mu nu, an eta mu nu, I'm sorry, an eta mu nu. That's the signature of the metric of space time. And there was a plus or a minus, I don't remember, 1 minus zeta, the gauge fixing term, time k mu, k nu over k2, okay? So you see that the fact that we are dealing with fields which carry charges, which are colored charges, means simply that there is a conservation of the law. So now you see I have four by four, so you have 11 different propagators. But in fact, you see that those delta functions mean there are only four different kinds of propagators. There is a propagator where I have a blue particle entering, and a blue particle going out. This is when I is equal to 1, G equal to 1, and L bar equal to 1, and K equal to 1. Okay, I have these propagators when I equal to 1 and G equal to 2 and L equal to 1 and K equal to 2. So this is, means that I have a 1, 2, 2, 1. I have the symmetric propagator like that, and I have this propagator. So you see, so out of the 11 possible propagators for the free gauge fields, only 4 of them are non-zero. And that's, of course, because of the U2 symmetry. And they are all equal. They are equal to the propagator of the ordinary Maxwell field. You see? So I can represent, so therefore, what I can is that I can represent this set of objects as simply a propagator with two lines, independently. These are gauge fields, so I will represent them by wavy lines. So instead, you see, so you have the propagator of the photon is a wavy lines, but these wavy lines carry two colors. One color associated to the I index of the gauge field, and one color associated to the G index of the gauge field. And wherever, whether I is one, this color is one, or is red or blue, or this color is red or blue, or whether the index here is one or two, or the index here is one or two, the incoming color, the incoming index, or the incoming color gets out. You see? Here and here. And therefore, you see that the color index, or the charges of the carried by the gauge field are conserved. You see? Because simply they are carried by these sublines, and what comes in gets out. You see? Okay. So now let us do the same thing for the fermions. For the fermions, the fermions carry a Dirac index. I get, by the same reason exactly, a delta I G bar times the propagator alpha beta for the Dirac field. Okay? So I can represent the propagator I have only out of the 4 possible fermion propagator, 2 only survive, the one where I have 1, 1, and 2, 2. So I see that, in fact, I have two possible photon propagator, the red one and the blue one. Well, this is not blue. This is not blue. This is blue, okay. So I represent the diagram for the propagator by a single line here, which may carry a color index. You see? Okay. Okay. Now, what is the propagator for the ghosts? Okay, and this is a Dirac propagator, so that's 1 over p slash minus I max. Okay? What is propagator for the ghost? Same game, the propagator for the ghost, C. Now, the ghost carry two index, C bar, K, L bar, 0, with the time order index. But, well, for the same reason, I get here the same quantity. I get that this is delta I L bar, delta G K bar, times the propagator for a scalar particle, delta for a scalar particle, the propagator for a scalar particle, 1 over p squared. Therefore, this means that the ghost carry, as the gauge field, two colors. So here is how I should represent the ghost propagator. It has an arrow here because it's carry a ghost number, a charge, because I'm creating C and I'm adding C bar in the same way that if I create a fermions, I have to annihilate the fermions or create an anti-fermions. But in addition, it carries colors like that, which are also goes from in two directions. This represents the I index. This represents the G-bar index. This represents the L index. This represents the K index. And the fact that you have two lines going on means that the color carried by the ghost field are also conserved along the propagation. Okay? So, well, that's quite trivial. What is interesting? So this is the ghost propagator. And this is the fermion propagator. Fermion propagator. Okay? So now I am coming to the interesting part. When you are going to represent what are the, how do you represent the vertex associated to the interaction between the gauge field and the interaction between the gauge field, the Fermi field, and the ghost field? They contain the FABC. Okay? The FABC for the U2 matrix are combination of, for SU2, there were epsilon IGK. For the U2, they are slightly different because now you have one more index. But once you compute them, you realize that they are just all the FABC are combination of deltas, of conservation law. Okay? And therefore, you can immediately rewrite all the interaction terms as like with diagrams where the index, the color index are conserved. So for instance, I had originally a vertex representing the interaction between three vector fields. You see, coming from the fact that in F mu nu, I may have a d mu a nu times a rho times a sigma. Remember? So the three vector fields, in fact, correspond to a thing where I have a vector boson carrying two color indices, which, for instance, splits into two vector fields carrying two color indices. And what's happening is that, in fact, as you might expect, those color indices are conserved. This means that if you have here an A I G bar mu E, here you have an A K L bar nu, and here you have an A M N bar rho interacting, the only vertex which have no zero contribution are the one where I equal N bar, G equal K, because this is I, this is G bar, this is G, so here this is G, K, this is K, this is I. So this, well, that's, I'm sorry, this is I, G, but what I, this is not K, this is in fact what I should call here N bar equal K. No, that's okay. Yes, no, so G has to be equal to K, so this is in fact L and L. So this is the only diagram which survives. You see? And in addition, of course, you still have, besides that, the factor associated to the fact that this vertex carry indices. So you have, in fact, minus G delta mu nu. And if you take into account the fact that this vector fields carry a momentum K, these vector fields carry a momentum P, and these vector fields carry a momentum Q. So P, K, P, and Q are four momenta, the four momenta carried by each vector bosons. You have a term which is delta mu nu K minus P nu, and plus three other components, delta mu rho q minus p nu, plus delta rho mu p minus k nu, which means that when computed this contribution of this vertex, you have to take into account the polarization of this incoming vector fields and project it. You have to take into account the difference between the incoming momenta for those two vector fields and project it on the polarization of this vector field. Yes? Don't. Well, the Lorentz indices are associated.
Like your first K minus.
Pardon?
Rho index instead of.
New rho. This is new rho mu, and of course this is rho. Yeah, and this is rho. I'm sorry. And this is rho mu. Mu. Yeah, thank you. Okay. Okay, but the color are conserved. Yes?
Should you have a term that looks like q minus k rather than 2p minus k's?
K minus p. Oh, I'm sorry. Yeah, I'm very. Yeah, yeah, of course. It's q minus k. K minus p, q, yes, that's q minus k. Or that's rather k minus p. Yeah. This is, yeah. Okay. Up to sciences, of course. So, yeah. Okay. So now the same for so this is the three vertex. Okay. So now the same for the same occurs for the four vertex. So let us rewrite it. Well, I prefer to keep this. So for the moment, I hope everybody will see it. What's happening for the four gluon vertex. The four gluon vertex, there is a four gluon vertex. But in fact, the only things which survive, as you may expect, are vertices like that when you have conservation of the momenta. You see? So this means that if you have a gluon vertex IEG, A mu mu KL, A rho MN and A sigma OP, and with P bar, N bar, L bar, G bar. This means that I has to be equal to P bar, G has to be equal to K, L has to be equal to M, N has to be equal to O. Okay? And for this term, the coupling constant associated to this term is simply minus I g squared. And then you have a delta mu nu delta rho sigma minus delta mu rho delta nu sigma minus delta mu nu delta rho sigma. So you have a term which takes into it. Which takes into account the Lorentz indices. So it tells you how you must contract the polarization. So you have either, this means basically that either you contract the polarization of this incoming photon with the polarization of, you take the scalar product of the polarization of those two photons times the scalar product of the polarization of those two photons, or you take the products of the scalar of the polarization of those two photons times the scalar product of the polarization of those two photons, and one contribution comes with a plus sign, and one contribution comes with a minus sign. Okay? But as far as all the color indices are constructed, you get this simple term. Okay. Now, what is it for the interaction between the photon and the gauge field and the psi? And that's where things become really interesting. Okay. Here I have a photon. These photons carry two charges. This vector field carries two charges. Here I have the fermion. The fermions carry one color charges. And as you may expect, if you have an I charge carried by the fermions, it comes out as one of the charge of the vector field. And the other charge carried by the vector fields becomes the charge of the photon, of the fermions, you see? So if you have an incoming fermion with a given charge, so either it's red or it's blue, and if it interacts with a vector field which has two charges, it may exchange its charge, its colors, with the fermion. You see, it may exchange its color. So if you have a blue fermion and a red-blue vector field, this allows the fermion to switch its color. Okay. So since the vector fields carry charges, they may change the charge of the fermions. The fermions which are, has a blue charge may become a fermion with a red charge. It cannot become an antifermion, but it can may become a fermion with a different color. Okay? And last but not least, now remember that we had ghosts. So this is for the fermions. For the ghosts, we have exactly the same kind of interaction. Now remember now that the ghosts carry also charges, but now they carry two colors because they belong to the same representation of the group as the gauge field. So a ghost may be blue-blue or blue-anti-blue, blue-anti-red, red-anti-blue or red-anti-red. But when interacting with the gauge field, it may interact like that. It may exchange one of its colors with one with the colors of the vector field. It, but of course, then for the gauge field, you may also have this phenomenon occur for the ghost. So you may also have, if you have ici, here you have I G bar and G and I bar. Okay. You have K bar, because in fact that's just the opposite of this of this of this of this configuration. Okay, and with a coefficient, which in that case is minus. So in that case, the coefficient associated to this is minus G times the Kuplik constant and I times P mu, where remember that the ghost, this gauge field carries an index and a Lorentz index, but so it has to, the polarization has to be projected with the polarization of the incoming ghost. And in that case, I think it's the opposite, but I don't remember. It's either P or minus P, something like that. No, I think that's why you can invert that. Okay. So, and that's the standard formulation for the fermions. The fermions carry Dirac indices. The bosons carry color indices and the mu index. And the contribution of the vertex is, of course, proportional to the usual just G. There is perhaps a factor I. Okay, there is a, and then there is, of course, the gamma mu alpha beta. So it's just a standard interaction term between fermions and gauge field. But the, and the, all the contribution of the colors are taken into account by this factor. Okay? Okay. So you see the moral of this representation, it took me some time to represent it, but it's quite important, is that you, the moral of this representation is that, in fact, now, well, you have matter fields which carry two kinds of charges, blue charge or red charge. The gauge fields carry, well, they carry one charge which can be of two types. The gauge field carries two charges which can be of two types. Okay? The ghost field carry two charges which can be of two types. And those charges are conserved during the interaction. And you see it immediately the way I have written the vertex interaction. So the charges are conserved during the propagation of the particle in the vacuum, okay? Both for the gauge field, for the matter field, and for the ghost field. And the, in addition, the charges are conserved during the interaction, okay? And those charges are the charges I equal 1 or 2 of the original model. The fact that you have two charges comes from the fact you are dealing with a model with an U2 symmetry. So the fact that those charges are conserved, and in addition, so we, now you have finally two charges, the fact that those so charges are conserved, the charges are conserved during the interaction, and in addition, the way these charges are conserved, so the interchange of charge is symmetric. There is no difference. This is symmetric. Symmetric in I equal 1 or 2. You see, there you may imagine that you have a model where the charge are conserved, but the strength associated to the exchange of for instance, for a fermion, you may imagine that you have an interaction. If a fermion change of colors, it's different if the interaction difference is it goes from blue to red or if it goes to red to blue. Or the interaction is different if a blue fermion interacts with a blue gauge boson. Or the interaction may be different for a blue red boson interacting with the blue fermion than for a red gauge boson interacting with the red fermions. Here you see that the strength is always the same. The strength of the interaction in all vertices is independent of the indices. And those facts, in fact, indicate that there is a U2 symmetry. You see it from the interaction. So you see the charges are conserved and in a symmetric way. And from this, you can tell if somebody was giving you just the Feynman rules of this model, you know, saying you have particles, they carry charge. Here is how the charge is sent during the interaction. Just looking at this diagram, you can say, haha, there is a U2 symmetry hidden in this model. You see? Okay? Good. But that's a good point. Now, there is a bad point in this formulation, which is that the gauge field interacts with the ghost. So if you start from particle physical states which carry some color index, some fermions and some vector fields will carry some color charges. And they start to interact. Okay? Then at some point they interact with the ghosts. Okay? And so some of the charges may go into the sector where there are ghost particles, which is a sector with unphysical particles. It's a sector with Hilbert space. It's a part of the Hilbert space of the theory where you have negative norm states, negative probabilities, or probabilities higher than 1. But okay, so that's a problem. But remember that you have also interaction in that case. You can also create unphysical states for the gauge boson. So states where you have bosons with longitudinal polarization, which are also unphysical states because some of them are also negative norm states. So in this picture, you have the symmetry, which it's clear that the symmetry is preserved, but the symmetry can flow a priori in the unphysical sector because the charges may go into states with ghosts and into states with longitudinal gauge field, gauge field with longitudinal polarization. Okay. So all the difficulty of the studies of gauge field is how to show that the charges which enters in the physical sector. Comes out in the physical sector. Okay. And that's equivalent, in fact, to show that the physical observable are gauge invariant, namely, in particular, independent of the gauge fixing condition zeta. Because remember that as in quantum electrodynamics, the photon propagator has a part which depends on the gauge fixing parameter. And we want that everything to be independent of the gauge fixing parameter at the end. Otherwise, this means that something has gone wrong in our quantization procedure. Okay? So now, we end up with this problem. And it took, I think, about more than 15 years before the first the invention of non-abelian gauge theories by Young and Mills, and the proof that you can construct the theory of gauge interaction, non-abelian interacting gauge vector, which do not suffer from this problem, and in addition, which is, of course, renormalizable. Because, as we shall see next time, from those interacting vertices, you construct a theory with a lot of diagrams, with a lot of loops. They may contain virtual states with high energy and high momenta. So there will be, a priori, ultraviolet divergences. And the ultraviolet singularities, when you're unnormalized, may spoil the Wool symmetry. So it's only in the beginning of the 70s that it was proven by several group of very bright people that indeed you can renormalize gauge theory respecting gauge invariance and in such a way that you do not create unphysical states out of physical states. In other words, you have a theory which respects unitarity and causality. And I'm going to explain very briefly, because it's very technical and you need a lot of calculation, but I will briefly discuss the basic idea of how this was done next time and what the result will be in order to just give you the result of what the beta function of a gauge theory interacting with fermion is. Okay? But I wanted to give you this general picture. Because it's also very useful when you study more general gauge theory. Okay. Yes?
So, like, this is great and all, but we still went to U2 instead of SU2. So, So, at some point, we're going to have to add some sort of blue anti blue plus red anti red condition.
Yeah. Okay. I will.
Can that be independent?
It can be done very easily. In fact, I cheated you when I wrote the action. Because I wrote an action which is most. I started from the U2. Field and I wrote a Young Mill action. And I forgot there is another term which is invariant, which breaks the U2 symmetry into an SU2 cross U1. I will explain that briefly next time. In fact, of course, as class, the U2 group is in fact SU2 times U1, or if you want to be precise, SV2 times 2U1 divided by Z2, because if you multiply a unitary matrix by minus 1, it's still a unitary matrix. If it has determinant minus 1, if you multiply it by minus, it's still a unitary matrix, okay? And these groups is in fact the product of two simple groups. So this is not a simple group, and the associated Lie algebra is not simple in the sense that it can be broken into two independent subparts. And this means that in fact, if you want to build a theory with U2 symmetry, you may introduce two coupling constants. And I will explain that later. But the Feynman rules are unchanged, but for an armless point. I will explain that later. So one can go back to the SU2 symmetry out of the U2, but those rules of conservation of colors are easiest to see in the U2 case. Okay.
Two questions roughly. You said that the epsilon tensors come out of the delta functions, the delta tensors.
Yes.
And I see a problem when you're trying to generalize it to say UN, because there the Fs are not necessarily expressible in terms of, would they be expressible in terms of deltas for general?
I think the F, I'm not very familiar with the SUN. I'm sure some of you are much more familiar with the group theory than I am. But for you can play this trick for any
SUN, UN.
Any UN group, in fact.
And the other thing is that this way of representing the Feynman diagrams, the vertices seem to disappear and everything seems to be just...
No, they are still vertices. This is one vertex. This is one vertex. This is one vertex. This is a line. This is a propagator. It's not something, it's not a string. It's not some extended object. Simply, instead of writing, you should, this is very, they are short together. You should, this picture is perhaps wrong. You should view this propagator like as this one. You should view a gauge field propagator as something like this. Okay? And you should view a gauge field, you should view a ghost propagator as something like this. Okay? Yes, I'm separating the lines because, but this is one particle with two associated colors propagated in spacetime. But this is one particle, it's not an extended object with something in between. No, it's not a string. It's a one particle. Okay.
How can we add three?
Pardon? Can we?
So it's on. I just wondering.
ON, you mean ON?
Green.
Pardon?
So it's green. Does the green charge just come in with SU3 then?
The green chart? Yes. In fact, well, you are going ahead of what I was going. If you, yes, in fact, the solution of the problem is that now if you assume that you may have also three charges, so one blue, one red, and one green, you can play the same game. You will have three charges, symmetries between the three charges, so you need some kind of invariance under rotation and space where you have three. You have a vector, you know, states with three possible states and invariance. So you are, in fact, in U3. So if you take three colors, you have U3. So you can get SU3 and you get the standard chromodynamic model. If you take four colors, you have SU4. Five colors, you have SU5 or U5, etc.
I wasn't sure if it was.
Pardon?
I wasn't sure if it was the obvious way or not.
No, but it is the obvious way. Well, life is not as hard as one finds when dealing with non-abelian gauge theories. There is this beautiful mathematical structure associated with symmetry comes out in nice ways. Okay.
Today, Jürgen is going to come and meet you guys after the tutorial. So
tutorial's at 2:00, and then he's coming at 3:30.
Right.
He might.